How did growing up speaking English as a second language influence your writing now?
It had a pretty enormous influence because I felt that English was something that I had to sort out, puzzle out. And when I started doing that, I think I didn't want to stop. And so I became fascinated with language and with reading and with playing with language and puns. And I always was curious about what could be done in English. So I think that's one piece of it. I think the other piece of it is that my poetry, even though I don't write in Spanish, I love reading poetry in Spanish, is haunted by those syntaxes that are deep in my mother tongue, as it were. And I think that they inhabit my poems and add a kind of syntactical strangeness, a new texture to it, that I think turns out to create a kind of interesting sound.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast all about authors from the Western U.S. Our funding comes from public radio members and Humanities Montana. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Carmen Jimenez-Smith about her poetry collection titled Milk and Filth. Well, before we dive into the contents of the book, let's talk about the cover.
Okay.
So we've got to give people who are listening a picture of this cover. So the background is pink, and then there's a figure of a naked woman. And across her head, blocking out part of her head, is your name. And then across her breasts is milk. And then across her nether regions is the word filth. Is this a concept that somebody at the publishing company came up with, or did that come out of a strategy meeting? It's really a great cover.
My husband designed the cover, and I knew that when the book was accepted, I wanted him to design it. He understood my vision of a couple of important influences. One of them is the artist Ana Mendieta, who used her body in her artwork and was really phenomenal and is an important influence in the book. And the other piece was I wanted to evoke that body positive energy of the 70s. This book is an homage to second wave feminism. And so when my husband and I were talking about what we wanted to do, we said, well, you know, I wanted a woman's body on the cover. And so we thought, oh, well, I guess it's got to be ours. And this is like one that I know of nude picture of me in the world. I took a bunch of pictures when I was pregnant with my son because my body was changing and I wanted to see what that was about. And so I used this photograph of when I was in the early stages of my pregnancy with my son as the cover. And then my husband had the idea of doing Milk and Filth as covering it, which was brilliant.
I just want to tell people that it's not like a color picture of you nude. It's a graphic representation.
Yeah.
Lots of little, what is it, silver
pixelation
or gray dots in the pink. Anyway, I thought it was a cover that was very unique, kind of like what's in the book. The first section of the book is titled Gender Fables. And the titles of the poems in that section only, not in the other two sections, are in brackets. What's going on with that?
I wanted to represent that they were a subset of the idea of gender fables, so that it's part of a longer series. But I think I was also suggesting about how the approach of that section of the book, and I'm still engaging with gender fables in different ways, was thinking about how women inscribe themselves onto narratives like folktales, which are stories that women really shared and changed and added their own bits to it. So I wanted to also acknowledge that the titles that I was using were part of that adapting, changing tradition of folklore.
What is your definition of a gender fable?
I think that a gender fable is a story that's meant to warn, train, counsel, condone, condemn a woman or a man, but I think that folklore is a way of communicating mores that often are related to how women should behave or should act. And yeah, I think that that's how they work. They are about training, counseling, explaining things to women.
Like Little Red Riding Hood?
Like Little Red Riding Hood, like Sleeping Beauty, like Beauty and the Beast. But also ways in which historical figures or you know, real life figures, living figures, their narratives are distorted or complicated. We see that right now in the election, the way that we don't really know who Hillary Clinton is because she's so distorted by gender fables, right? There are all of these ways and contexts through which we see her. We don't see a person. It's really hard. And I think that's a struggle that she faces as a candidate. I would imagine anyone in that position would, because there are so many exterior forces shaping her narrative.
I think that's really true, that before someone knows you as a person, and that's part of what you're saying in this book, they see you as an ethnicity or as a gender.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In the final lines of your poem titled, "And the Mouth Lies Open," the narrator says, "I'm a science fiction movie, and electrocution makes me a Frankenbride in technicolor abjection." I know I've taken that out of context, but can you say more about that Frankenbride image?
That poem is a bit of an homage to Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath and women who suffered from mental illness. And in those days, they were treated through electroconvulsive therapy. And so I was thinking of all of the different ways in which women's bodies and their minds, the way that women's bodies and minds have been treated when women have been in despair or in pain or suffering. And so I thought that those interventions kind of create like a Frankenstein figure, one that's externally manipulated in really violent ways, and all of the ways that can take place.
Mm. Yeah, certainly. Nobody said, "Oh, it's okay."
Exactly, exactly. Or that your pain is real, right?
Yeah, mostly they said you shouldn't be feeling that. You shouldn't be behaving that way.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to hear one of the poems, and let's start with Queenly. I'd like to hear several of the poems, actually.
Okay. Queenly. The bell's chain is held back from striking against wonderment by the angel's heavy hand. The angel represents ruin. The decline of me got started in the coiled heart of old wives' tales, nightmares of history. A woman can't hold all that storm in her head, so she surrenders to it.
So did you just describe the history of patriarchy in 10 lines?
I tried. I tried. I was really trying in many of these poems for kind of minimalism, a real tight, tight image system. That was a formal experiment for sure, that poem started out being much, much longer.
That's what I really enjoyed about your poetry, is even though all poetry is compressed narrative, your poems somehow compressed it even farther. Is that something that you really have to work at?
I think it's something that I feel compelled to do. I'm always thinking about how can this be tighter? Because it's about the music. It's about arriving at a kind of sublime sound in which you're transported through the sound. And they're just grammatical constructions that are bulky and they remind us of thinking. And I like language that reminds us of feeling what we think.
There's a poem on page 9. I don't know what the name of it is, but it looked like it was all one sentence. It didn't have any punctuation.
Yeah.
And when I read it, my first thought was, I really want to hear the author read this.
Okay. Llorona's Soliloquy. The river's dried up, once made of my hair, I've left behind rubble, but it's thinking of all of us that I make a tiny baby funeral of my tears, and they make me a reason for beating, so I had better find the thing I left behind, since it was precious, like the plaza, where I used to throw coins and wish for someplace else to be, like the shimmer of coin in water, that newness, not the borne-down appendage, like the body is haven, as passageway, to life I make to death, because it's easier in the long-term shadow of this body and its vacuum.
There's so much about body in your work. What can you say about what you're saying in that poem?
Well, La Llorona mythology is really about female suffering and how motherhood is a type of suffering. I mean, I think it's this other narrative, but that's what I boiled it down to. And that female suffering is carried so much in the body. So I think that part of what I'm arguing is, or suggesting or playing with, is that we freight La Llorona with our own sorrows and our own guilts about our motherhood, because it's this other alternative body through which we can project that.
Hmm. Do you remember when you first became aware of the suffering of women and their bodies?
I think that because my parents and my grandmother, who I grew up with, just had to work so hard. And there was a way in which I saw that my mother and my grandmother had to work twice as hard or three times as hard to attain some of the same kinds of sense of selfhood that men growing up I saw would experience. So I think I was always aware of it, but maybe didn't have the language for it or didn't understand that that was a larger political problem until I think I got older and I began to read, and I kind of found myself reading feminists literature, you know, in high school. I think it was just in the air in the 80s in a way. The people who had been so active and excited about it in the 70s were becoming teachers and were becoming members of the community. And so I was lucky to have experienced it and just sort of decided at a very early age that I was a feminist. But I think that it always ties back to the labor of female bodies and how hard female bodies have to work in different contexts. And also that it's impossible to be female and not be aware of your body. That the idea of sending my daughter out to go be and go hitchhiking in the world is unthinkable. And it's only because of the body that she has.
If you're anything like me, you had an idea that you could do things differently from the way your mother did. And then when you have children, that idealism is kind of shattered.
Exactly. Yeah, the terrors that my mother had for me that I found insane are now exactly the terrors that I live with, because I've had to live in this body and be in this world for a long time with it and realize, like, oh, this is not easy. This is not as easy as it is to be in other bodies.
And then you wonder why other women didn't go even crazier than they did.
Exactly, exactly.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Carmen Jimenez-Smith. If you just joined us, you can hear what you missed online. mtpr.org is the place to listen on demand or to sign up for our podcast. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. It seems like you have worked through a lot of that, the body issues and the being female and the feminism in your writing. And your memoir, which seemed to me like a cross between poetry and prose,
mm-hmm.
it was really a lot of the succinctness that's in your poetry. You tackle a lot of those issues in really interesting and unique ways. Did that just come out of journaling?
That one came out of a few different things. I remember when I started writing that book, I was at a conference in Denver, and I was pregnant with my daughter. I was about 6 months pregnant. I was weaning my son, so I was just a body. I was really this vessel. And I was going to go to the hotel, and I thought, oh, I'm going to be in this hotel room. I'm going to have all this time to myself to sleep. It's going to be wonderful. But I couldn't sleep. And at the time, my mother's health was deteriorating. We didn't know it at the time. We suspected it, but she had Alzheimer's. And so it was just this convergence of life and death in that moment. And I'd been reading work by writers like John DeGatta, Jenny Bouley, Eula Biss, lyric essayist Maggie Nelson, and was really drawn to the form, which is a hybrid. It is a hybrid between the essay and the poem. It is about compression. I think it's also about the space, and it's about threading multiple ideas and impulses into a work. And the first words that are in the book are the first words that I began writing it. And at the time, I thought I was just writing an essay. And then after I wrote the essay, I think more and more things were happening with my mother's health. And I thought, I want to experience writing a whole book. And so I kept pushing myself, and different threads came and different decisions came at different times. But I was constantly writing those passages down. And then when I would find time, I would weave them into the book. And then when the book had more form, then I started making decisions and creating more fluid connections. And it was kind of a joy to write. It was difficult. It was very difficult, but it was also wonderful to learn from.
Seemed like it was also would have been a little exposing. You had to make yourself really vulnerable to put those words down on the page.
Yeah, I think at the time what I felt was I felt lonely. And I felt loneliness connected to shame, right? Because I had these really conflicting, complex feelings about motherhood and my own mother and mortality. And I felt like when you're a mom, you have to be just boundless love and devotion. And I wasn't feeling that. And I felt like I can't be the only person in the world that feels that way. And part of the great privilege that I have as a writer is that I can say these things and make it so that if someone else is just the way that when you read someone and you say, oh, I thought I was the only person in the world who felt that way. I wanted to be able to put myself out there so other people would feel like, oh, it's okay that I don't like my child, or, you know, whatever complicated feelings I expressed. And people have told me that that book has been helpful to them in that way. So I think it was important that I do that, and I learned from doing that that I would always want to do that as a writer.
You've also heard that you're a bad mother.
I have heard that I'm a bad mother, yeah. And you know what? I just want to be a good enough mother. My kids are wonderful, and they're self-sufficient, and they are seeing a person who is enjoying the work that she does and enjoying her marriage and enjoying her family and also creating spaces for herself. And they model that same behavior. And I think it's called autonomy. And I'm proud of them for that. And I can find 100 different ways to find other women bad mothers, but I don't oppress other women. I don't participate in that. So obviously I'm outraged when women do horrible things to their children, but I don't care if your kid drinks apple juice. I really don't.
Well, don't you think that's part of the oppression that women have experienced, is other people expecting you to be a good mother, a perfect mother?
Absolutely. Yeah. Horizontal oppression is the enemy of feminism. It's the enemy of people of color coming together to combat, you know, white supremacy. But it's a very useful tool. I mean, we see it right now. In fact, I think the election is a perfect example, because at the end of the day, there's a very, very small coterie of people who are oppressing us all of us gun owners, pro-right, pro-life, pro-choice, all of us are being oppressed by these same small coterie of rich people. But we're oppressing each other through hate, and that's great for that 1%. They're thrilled when we're fighting about trifling things because they have all our money now.
I'm just going to pop in for a moment to remind people that I'm Sheree Newman, talking with Carmen Jimenez-Smith about her latest book, Milk and Filth. This is The Right Question. for me, one of the most powerful lines in this collection of poetry or this book was this: the colonizing worm is buried deep in you. Again, you've used very few words that just conjure this huge swath of history. The colonizing worm.
Mm-hmm.
It's that thing that is deep within us, where we are expected to behave a certain way and conform and make a certain amount of money. And
yeah.
And then we're supposed to live under that oppression.
Yeah.
What do you see as freedom?
I think freedom has to begin in a way. And I know that part of it, I have a great deal of privilege. And so it's easy for me to say that it has to start from within, because I have the great luxury of being able to facilitate it. But that is being comfortable and satisfied with oneself, and that a kind of just basic ability to survive. I think everybody needs the ability to survive. I think that's freedom. And I'm actually not free if other people can't survive. You know, like I live on the backs of other people. Everything that I own, my telephone, is covered in the labor of people who are living in atrocious conditions. And so I'm not free. I'm imprisoned by that. I think that if we're able to create a world, and I'm totally pie in the sky, if we're able to create a world in which people can take care of themselves and their families and find fulfillment, I think then we're all free. But until that happens, I think that we're all just tied into something very ugly and very inhumane.
Well, you're modeling that to your children. I think that's what we have to do.
Yeah.
To move to the next level.
Yeah.
When you're out doing readings out of this collection, what's your go-to poem? What poem do you read every time you do a reading?
In this book?
Mm-hmm.
That's a good question. I like Fragments from the Confessions. It's my Sylvia Plath poem, so I like that one a lot.
Okay, let's hear it.
Okay. Fragments from the Confessions. Take the jar and crack it open. The jar is a plaster cast of my down there, so take that jar to the end of a tunnel. Defile that jar, burn it, tag it. Venerate it with dung and Sappho. Don't hang my jar over me. It's my jar. It's my jar. Decoupage the jar with mouths cut from Cosmo, Mr. Death. Fill it with our minstrel blood or the placenta from our collective lacunae. Grow lascivious magnolias in it, heavy-lipped and lush with pollen. The jar houses my illusions of eating men like hairballs.
What did your husband think of that last line?
He loves it. He loves the poems, luckily for me.
In your memoir, you wrote, "Why I Became a Writer, to Write My Mother's Way Out of Tedium."
I think my mother will be in everything that I write and will be a subject or a ghost in everything that I write for the rest of my life. My mom is, she has Alzheimer's and it's very advanced, so it's such a kind of complicated way to think about her present and her past. She was just such a vibrant, dynamic, interesting, funny, engaging, charismatic person who had to work, like, you know, all her life, 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. And I think of different writers who've talked about the sublimation of their mothers and of women in history who made quilts or who became excellent hostesses in their homes, these women who could have been artists. And so I think that part of what I do is in honor of the artist that my mom never was. She wanted to be an artist. She wanted to be something bohemian and traveling and an artist or a dancer or a singer or something. And so it never even occurred to her that it was possible. It was always in the purview of dream. And so I think that everything that I do is because she said to me that I could do it. And if she hadn't have done that or said that, I wouldn't have. So she's in everything I do.
It's really hard to watch somebody not be connected anymore.
It's very hard. It's very hard. But I'm grateful for everything that I am because of her, and still am because of her, because she still fulfills my spirit in such deep ways, just by trying to stay connected, by trying to stay funny and charming and you know, engaged.
I heard you call your poetry gestural earlier today. What did you mean by that?
I spend a lot of time thinking about how language, syntax, creates change, creates a shift in the currents of how we think. And it's a combination of music and syntax. And I like to do things that are very pronounced, those kinds of shifts. So I'm not a conversational poet. The writing is a little bit more arch than conversation. And that compression that we talked about earlier is a big part of making sure that when there are shifts, that they're detectable, that they have substance for the reader. I think of those as kinds of gestures.
So Billy Collins need not worry about any encroachment from you.
he's a very, very figurative poet. Like, he uses so many kinds of tropes, figure tropes in his work. So his work has a kind of gestural quality. But I think that his sentiments are a little bit different, and I think that I would strive for more compression. I would love to edit Billy Collins. Let's just put it that way.
Billy, you hear that? I'd like to end with you reading the poem titled When God Was a Woman.
Okay, thank you. When God was a woman. When God was a woman, empire was meh. When God was a woman, we built schools of listening, and every week we sat quietly until we could hear each other's thoughts. No shadows when God was a woman. Little girls had great dominion, and grandmothers were venerated. Sky was the giant bellows of her inside. The grace of God meant flowing and willowy. This was when God was a woman. She played harmless pranks because she liked keeping things light. She made it rain on her collective good hair days. When she met someone who seemed fun and a little mysterious, she invited him into heaven. Then she made her daughter blind for a week, which in retrospect was kind of mean, but her daughter made the best of it.
Carmen Jimenez-Smith lives in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Look for more information about her and her books, and sign up for our podcast at mtpr.org. Also there, children's book reviews, poetry, and links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting The Right Question since 2008. And thanks to you for listening and for your financial support. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you piles of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.